All right, so last week, as I said, we started a lesson on the I am, the use of I am in the Bible, both by God and by Christ. So we have God the Father and God the Son. Both are deity. They both share a divine nature. I don't mean that they are both the same entity. That would be wrong, and we clarify that in the lesson. They are both self-existent. They don't answer to anyone outside of themselves in order to exist or to do anything. They don't depend upon your or my or our approval to do what they do as God. And so that's something that we need to understand going into a series like this and really going into a study like this here. This I am expression is also directly tied to covenant relationship. That's a really important feature here. God is the covenant maker, and God is the God of whatever covenant he makes with people. He's the God of that covenant. So you didn't, if you're in covenant with God, which you are if you're a Christian, you did not go to God and say, I want to make a covenant with you. Here's my terms. I just need you to agree with this. You don't have authority to do that. You don't have the right to do that. And God is the only one that can do that. So he's the one who holds the covenant, who writes the covenant, and you agree to that or you don't. Okay? Jesus's part in all this is that he gives life to that covenant through his blood. Whenever we talk about blood in that context, we're talking about life. So we just honor Jesus's body and his blood. So we're not just honoring just his physical body and his literal visceral blood there, although that too, but more importantly, we're honoring his life. Because that's what his body and his blood represent, as a offering of life to us. The gospel provides the terms and conditions of salvation. And if you are a Christian, it's not because you made a covenant with Christians or congregations or the church worldwide or angels or anything else. It's because you have a covenant with the Father through the Son. Again, Father owns salvation. He makes covenants of salvation. The Son gives life to those covenants through his blood. That's a recap, basically, of what we talked about last week. Now we're going to step into Jesus' role as the I am. And what does he say? He says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, if you look in John chapter 8, verse 20, a few verses later, it says that he spoke these words while he was in the treasury area in the courtyard of the temple. According to historical documents, there were two huge lampstands in that treasury area on which multiple lamps hung. And these lamps were lit after the evening sacrifice, and that light was seen throughout most of the city since the temple area was in a raised area over most of the city. So Jesus places himself conspicuously and intentionally in proximity to these artificial lights. I'm saying artificial simply because they didn't spontaneously generate themselves on their own. So this is something interesting to us. Jesus is sending a message that he alone is able to provide light that is necessary for the human soul to live forever. These lights here, might have even pointed to them, for all I know. These lights here, they're only here for a short time. These lights here only have limited scope. They can only do so much, and they will be put out eventually. But this light, referring to himself, this light can save your soul, and it can bring your soul life forever. So Jesus, being the light of the world, excels beyond all that preceded him and all who come after him. He has no earthly equal. We don't say things like, well, Jesus is a light that is better than, you know, this other religious figure or this other so-called savior. There are no other lights apart from him. I will say, and we'll talk about it later in the lesson, you know, we are to be lights of the world, but not standalone lights. Our light is fully dependent upon him. We'll get to that in due time. So he doesn't say that I am a light of the world, as if there were equally comparable lights, but he's the only light that has real and lasting quality and the only light that can save you. So to wrap up my introduction here, Jesus' objective is not merely to enlighten you for a church service or for a few weeks or for a few years, but forever. His light that he provides does not depend upon your or my power, energy, or ability. We ought to give full attention to him because we need him so much. And if there's ever a day where you feel like you don't need Jesus as much as you did, say, the day before, that's not true. You always need him desperately. We want to get that into our heads, and we want to not only hear that, we want to believe that because that serves our best interest. All right, let's look at John chapter 1, if you're still there. Look at verse 4 and 5. It says that in him, in Christ, was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. We'll talk about that word comprehend in a minute. First of all, when we think of light, we always should think that light requires a source or something that creates it. Light doesn't just happen by itself without something causing it. You think about the earth, for example. The earth does not generate its own light. The light that we have here, I'm talking about natural light here, is not from here. It's we are lit by the sun. The moon is the same way. The moon is lit by the sun. That moon you see at night, especially when it's a full moon, it can provide quite a bit of light at night, but it doesn't have its own light. If any of you are familiar with Pink Floyd's Eclipse song from The Dark Side of the Moon, at the end of the song, Roger Waters says, there is no dark side of the moon, really. In fact, matter of fact, it's all dark. And it's true. The whole moon is dark. There is no light-generating source on that moon. If the sun were not reflecting off of the moon, then the moon would be very dark and we'd never see it. So it's interesting that if we see something in the night sky, we point to that probably, like you see in the picture here, and there's something creating or causing or making that light happen. And we've done this many times sitting around the fire pit at night. We'll see satellites going over, and we look them up on our space app there, and we sometimes find out, well, that's a satellite, or it's just a piece of space junk, it's something out there floating, but there's always something creating that light. We don't just see lights going there, and there's no reason for them. There's a purpose to that. Light is never automatically generated. Something creates it, makes it happen. So I want us to... in fact, if someone's wondering about the sun right now, well, the sun generates its own light. Actually, the sun is making light by processes that it did not create or invent on its own either. There are nuclear processes going on in that were placed there, that were made, that were designed for that. But anyway, let's extend this to human nature. When we see godly attributes in people, and there's a lot to see, thankfully, selfless love, charity, kindness, mercy, forgiveness, virtue of any kind. These are like lights among humankind, and they outshine all other behaviors. You know, if you look at people, it's real easy to get very cynical about people right now because there's just so much ugliness and so much badness and so much darkness out in the world. I'm speaking of human nature now. But there's these people every once in a while, and I'm not talking about Christians because we expect that from them. I'm just saying just in the world in general, we see people every once in a while that just are brilliant lights, you know, just like in the night sky. You just see these brilliant lights, and they're doing things that are just fantastic that we have to ask ourselves, where did that come from? Because remember, light always has a source. And we might say, well, in an immediate sense, that came from the one who demonstrated that, which is true. They made a conscious decision to do something. It wasn't an accident. I don't think anyone can be accidentally virtuous, do you? Or accidentally charitable, or accidentally show genuine love to someone. These are things that take a conscious, deliberate action here. But in an ultimate sense, where did the idea or the inspiration for that love or that charity or that forgiveness come from? Where did the inspiration for that come from? As all light requires energy to generate it, that's a scientific fact, human light requires a source of energy and inspiration and motivation. Those two are not accidents. There are many books and movies, personal testimonies about the unexpected, often unrequested, and sometimes unexplained noble behavior of people that stands out against the background or the backdrop of human selfishness and greed and apathy. Sometimes we'll just see virtually heroic effort. Someone will show love and they'll lay down their life for someone, whether they die in the process or not. That's not the point, but they're ready to make that supreme sacrifice. We see the love of parents as they sacrifice for their children. We see firemen running into burning buildings, and sometimes not even firemen, running into burning buildings to save people. We see in the midst of calamity and tragedy, people doing just heroic things to save other people at their own hurt, to their own peril. Why do they do this? These things here? You might say, well, because they chose to. I beg to differ. In the big picture, they were inspired to. That's what we're talking about here. They were inspired to do that. Well, and I'll talk about that a little bit more here in just a minute. While demonstrating godly virtue doesn't make you godly and righteous in God's sight, in itself, nonetheless, it is true that there is something or someone that can be credited as a cause for all those good things that is outside of that person. That person, if you could look at it in a visual way, it's like they're reaching for something and grabbing something outside of themselves and then exercising that in that behavior, that heroic effort, whatever it might be. And this is what John is saying about Jesus here. Jesus is the giver of life to humankind. And this life, he says there in verse 4 and 5 of John chapter 1, is what inspires us to act like God when we are on our best behavior. And even bad people can act in a good way when they want to. In John chapter 1, verse 3 and verse 10, we see that Jesus is the creator of the world. He made the world, and so he filled the world and people with light. Where does all this light come from amongst us? It didn't come from us. We can't generate that kind of light. We don't have the ability to do so. We are reflecting that light. We're radiating that light that was really put in all of us. John the Baptist was a light. Jesus said so. In fact, in John chapter 5, verse 35, he says so. But he was not the light. John the Baptist simply pointed to the light of the world and identified him as such. We know of many brilliant people throughout history, builders, inventors, philosophers, military leaders, statesmen, artists, writers, but none of them are self-lit, so to speak. They are all radiating this light that Jesus brought into the world. They're not the source of that light. I want you to even think about yourself, because this is how it all works. You got to make it personal. If you're capable of rational thought, and if you're capable of being creative or creativity itself, if you're capable of demonstrating acts of godly virtue and showing godly love, and I'll just give it to all of you that you're all capable of all these things, you need to ask yourself, where did that capability come from? Because doing those things is one thing. Being capable of them backs it up a step here and says, there must be a source of that. Where did that come from? You are not the origin of those things. You are not the source. You're simply inspired by something or someone else to do those things. And I'll give you all credit that you're doing them, okay? But the fact is, and I don't mean to discredit you here, but we're just being realistic here, that you didn't invent godliness. You didn't invent love. You were not the first one to, the origin or the source of virtue. You're not that person. You're not capable of that, and neither am I. I am certainly not the inventor of those things. So you may have nurtured those things or cultivated those things and exercised them, but again, you didn't invent them. I came across,
I've
come across this verse many times, but when I was preparing this lesson, this verse like stood off the page. 1 Corinthians 4:7, Paul is talking about the Corinthians who are boasting about how smart they are, how knowledgeable they are, how spiritual they are, and even though Paul's the one that brought the gospel to them and has trained them in such a way and has really enlightened them with the gospel, now they're kind of like saying, hey, Paul, we'll take it from here, thank you very much, but we've actually excelled beyond you in a way. And so Paul responds, he says, who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast of it as if you did not receive it? I think this speaks to a lot of people. This is a good question. Why would one boast in things that he received as gifts? He is not the source of those things. He's a recipient. He didn't create these things by his own power or authority. Now, to credit someone with talent and virtue without recognizing the source, well, you're falling into the same category as the Corinthians, which is basically arrogance and immaturity. So we want to give credit where credit is due. If there is light in your life, and I'm not even talking about it spiritually yet, I'll get to that in a minute, but if there is light in your life, if you're demonstrating love and virtue and acts of godliness and kindness and forgiveness, that came from somewhere. You should be looking up to where that came from. And it's one thing to be enlightened mentally with intelligence and talents and creativity. It's another thing to be enlightened spiritually, especially, in essence, seeking divine truth and the redemption of your soul and immortality. That requires the source of light on a completely different level. Now we're not just thanking God, hey, thank you for letting me be a forgiving person, or thank you for providing me with the capability to show virtue to others. Now we're thanking God really for saving us from ourselves. You can know about God and sin and salvation and the afterlife, but unless you had been given that knowledge, and that knowledge then is a gift, remember? You don't brag about the gift because you aren't the one who gave it. You're the recipient. That knowledge was given to you and to me, and it is impossible for you to know any of those things on your own. There's nothing that you know. I've said this for years, and I still throw down the challenge. There is nothing that you can know about the spiritual realm that God didn't tell you was true. Nothing at all. You wouldn't know anything about God as a personal being unless he revealed himself to you. You wouldn't know that you have a soul unless God told you that. You wouldn't know that you were in sin or that you needed salvation unless God revealed all this to you. You wouldn't know that there is an afterlife, whether it's heaven or hell. You wouldn't know anything about that for certain. You might have guessed or something, but you wouldn't know that for certain factually unless God had revealed that to you. And that revelation to you is a gift. And you cannot brag about being the recipient of a gift. You should brag about the one who gave it to you. That's where your boast should be. You should be boasting about the giver, not being the receiver. A condemned soul cannot be the source of its own enlightenment. And we are all condemned souls left to ourselves. And therefore, we cannot enlighten ourselves spiritually by ourselves. And I mean that individually, like you yourself, or even us collectively, like we ourselves. We could all get together and try to enlighten one another spiritually, but take Christ out of the picture and we have nothing. We should be looking upward and seeing where this light comes from. Jesus, the I Am of the world, provides the source of all that is good in the world. But he can't help us unless we acknowledge this and make him the light of our world. What we need to do then And this is a tough call, but it's necessary. What we need to do then is to choose him over our world instead of it, as more important than it, as a priority rather than it. John chapter 1, verse 5 says, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it." That comprehend word is an interesting one here. Your margin might say overpower. The translators struggle with this word because it doesn't have a good way to translate from the Greek into English. The best understanding of that, as my studies have brought out, is the word receive. The darkness did not receive the light. Sin had so blinded the world that Jesus came into, and there was so much moral confusion, so entrenched was this moral confusion in the world, that many who saw the light in the form of Jesus, in bodily form, would not receive him. Even though he was the best thing that they had ever seen, they would not receive him because they were in darkness. Jesus did not enter into a world looking forward to the coming, except for a remnant of people. Rather, he entered into a world filled with darkness and confusion and spiritual ignorance that refused to receive the light because they were so accustomed to darkness. If you've ever been in a dark cave, and I mean like a completely absent of light cave, like I have been before, you know what real darkness is. Years ago, some of you probably been down to the eight caves down there, south of here, down in, where is that? South of here. Anyway, I can't remember offhand. But on the Boy Scouts, you know, we went down there with Logan and his troops, and we're going. It's an underground lava tunnel that goes on for over a mile underground, and there's these little portals of light. You can see this little portal. You can't see the full picture here, but there's little pockets of light that come in every once in a while. But outside of that, you are in absolute darkness, and it's a frightening thing to be in absolute darkness. It just does something to your head that scares you more than you can realize. I know that a lot of people think, well, if I was in darkness, I wouldn't be afraid. You probably haven't been in absolute darkness then, because it's a scary thing. And it's as if humanity was in a dark cave, and they were so used to that darkness that that darkness seemed normal to them. They were in a frightening place, and they didn't realize they were in a frightening place. They were in a bad situation, and they didn't see that it was a bad situation. We're seeing the same thing happening today. As the world in general descends more and more into moral darkness and spiritual confusion, we're seeing more and more people get accustomed to the darkness so that they don't even think anything about it. Until, of course, it's just too late. Jesus came from heaven and exposed how backward and spiritually ignorant and, yes, how deviant the world was that he came into, which is very much like what's going on today. Whenever we preach the gospel and whenever we live the gospel and whatever Jesus is held up to the world, so to speak, in whatever form through our example or through the preaching, it is a brilliant light against a very dark background. Because the world right now is very backward and spiritually ignorant and deviant. But it thinks that everything is okay. Have you heard that on the news? Have you heard that in mainstream media? Have you heard that in the schools? Have you heard that in the workplace? We're talking about behaviors and lifestyles and actions that 50, 100, 200 years ago would have been deplorable and condemned. In the Bible, they are condemned, and people are going around thinking that this is great that we're doing all these things, and we want you to applaud this. Not only do we want you to accept it, we want you to endorse it. And here comes the light of the gospel exposing just how backward and awful that really is. And so instead of welcoming him and welcoming his teaching with open arms, many people were suspicious of Jesus. They were very wary of him. They were very jealous of him. Now, when Jesus was healing people, of course, they were happy because they were relieved of their infirmities. But when he demanded allegiance and obedience and sacrifice, many people left him. Turn over, if you would, to John chapter 6. You see on the screen here that citation. John chapter 6, starting in verse 63, and we'll see an evidence of exactly what I'm talking about. John 6, starting in verse 63. Jesus says, "It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and are life. But there are some of you who do not believe, for Jesus knew from the beginning who they were who did not believe and who it was that would betray him. And he was saying, 'For this reason I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted him from the Father.' As a result of this and all the other things he had been saying, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore." It's all fun and games when Jesus is healing people, right? And when he's handing out free bread and fish, and when he's entertaining the crowds with parables of the kingdom and telling stories, and people are all gaga over this, and they're going, "Wow, this is really good." But when Jesus starts laying down the terms and conditions of what it means to be a disciple of his, things change, don't they? Everyone's happy when little or nothing is required of them. But when Jesus draws a line in the sand and says, "Are you with me or are you not?" many walked away disappointed, and they went back into the darkness from which they came. They retreated back into the darkness. You see the exact same thing happening today. When churches offer feel-good therapy and music and entertainment and coffee and donuts and all kinds of children church and everything, and they demand little or no actual commitment, everyone's happy, right? People flock to those churches. We've got them all around here. They're drawing in literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And look at us. We're preaching the truth here, and we're talking right out of the gospel here, and we can barely get, this place filled up. Why is that? Because people don't always want what the light offers. They would rather stay in the artificial light of man-made religion. I say artificial because it looks good, and it is light, but it's not a lasting light, and it's not the true light. It doesn't do the same thing as the light of the world does. All right, let's go back to John chapter 1 and start looking here really in verse 9. John goes on to say, John who's writing this says, "There was the true light which coming into the world enlightens every man." Now he's talking about the spiritual effect that Jesus has on people. "He was in the world and the world was made through him and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him." So here's Jesus who made the world. I didn't say that. John just said that. In fact, it's the second time in the short passage so far that he said that. Jesus who made the world came into the world. The Creator steps into his own creation. We talked about that last week. And the purpose for this was that the I Am of heaven is revealing himself to all who are made in his image. And he's not doing that to criticize or to judge or to destroy, but rather to save us. All the things that your soul needs. Mercy, grace, forgiveness, fellowship with God, providential help, hope for the future are all found not in church buildings, not in religion, and not under the strobe lights of man-made religion, but in Christ. He's the one who comes to save and to give many gifts to us. And remember, whenever we are given gifts, we should not boast because we are the recipients. We should boast because there is a giver who is so kind to us to have given us those gifts in the first place. But it says that the world did not know him. Those outside of God's covenant with Israel largely were ignorant of who this Jesus was and why he was there. In fact, it says his own did not receive him. And this is a reference to those who are in covenant with God, the Jews. They should have, of all people on the earth, they should have known who he was, been ready for him, welcome him with open arms, and just sat at his feet and said, whatever you say, Lord, you are Messiah, the Christ, and we are ready to serve. And that is not what happened, except for just a handful. They rejected him. Jesus is, in a sense, here he is the creator of the world. He is the source of all light for the virtue among humanity. And he walks into the world. It's like walking into a room full of strangers. Nobody is really paying attention to him, not for the right reasons anyway. In chapter 1 and verse 12 and 13, still in John, chapter 1, verse 12 and 13, it says, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. There's a gift. You don't become children of God on your own power or your own merit. You get the right to become a child of God. Even those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Of course, he's talking now in anticipation of Christians. All people are born of blood and flesh and the will of man, but only Christians are born of God or born again or born of water and the Spirit. Those three phrases used synonymously there. In fact, 1 John chapter 3, verse 1, John, same author, different place, he says, see how great a love the Father has bestowed on us that we would be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us because it did not know him. The same world that is completely ignorant about who Jesus was is probably going to be very ignorant about who we are, just as we also were probably very ignorant of what is going on here until we heard the gospel and did something about that. But it is a great privilege to be called a child of God. It is a great privilege because we don't deserve it. It is a great privilege because this right was given to us, and once again, we should not boast because we received it. We should be looking to the one who gave it to us and thank him with everything we have. But with privilege comes responsibility, doesn't it? Jesus says in Matthew 5:16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Jesus is not speaking this to Christians directly because there were no Christians yet, but it certainly does apply to us in principle. Anyone who follows Christ and becomes his disciple, he's speaking this to. But this is not assumed, this light of the world concept here is not something that you can assume. Just because we call ourselves Christians doesn't mean we're automatically acting as a light of the world. What it means, though, is that this is what ought to be. This is what God called us to be, which means that we need to do what is necessary to serve in that way. There's a measure of preparation involved or implied in this. You're not going to be the light of the world if you're living in darkness. So the only way that you can be a light of the world is to align yourself wholeheartedly with the true light of the world. So remember, light always has a source. And in order for us to be light of the world, we need to be filled with the true light, the one who needs no one to enlighten him, because he is the source of all enlightenment. We could go to another place, as we will right now, in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 7 through 11. Here's the Apostle Paul talking to Christians, and think about what he says in light of, no pun intended, all that we have said so far. Therefore, do not be partakers with them, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness and righteousness and truth, trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. First of all, we should say this is not a mere suggestion of Paul to the Christians then or now. Paul is not saying it would be really nice if you could do this, but if you don't, no big deal, we're still good. He's saying that this is required, and he's speaking from his apostolic authority. This here is a call to duty. This here is a definition of our responsibility as children of light. So let's break it down just a little bit and look at it individually. First of all, do not fellowship with darkness. You are in the world, you should not be of the world. Do not allow unbelieving family and friends and peers to dictate how you think, what you do, how you live, what you watch on TV, or whether you're going to be here or not in the assembly. This happens so often all across America, in churches everywhere, where someone else is getting a say as to whether a Christian is going to perform his or her duties as a Christian. And Paul is saying that ought not to be. Those people are living in darkness who are outside of Christ. Why are you letting them dictate how you live? But it's an easy thing to get sucked into, especially when you're trying to please someone else. Stay on good terms with everyone. I understand the pressure there, I do. We're also supposed to cultivate the fruit of the light. So it's not just a list of, well, don't do this and don't do that. There's some things to do. And this goodness and righteousness and truth, this requires positive input and constant training and constant reinforcement, which is one reason why we come together on a weekly and even bi-weekly basis, so that we can continually have that good, positive input of light from the scriptures in our fellowship. This is critical to your spiritual success. It's worth your investment. But it also means that you can't fill your head with worldliness and wickedness and lies and deception and think that it's okay. Or get all bent out of shape and indignant when someone calls you out on it when they see it in you. Because that happens, by the way. Light has nothing to do with darkness. Light never leads us to darkness. Light never becomes darkness. Learn what is pleasing to the Lord, Paul goes on to say. You know, there's a lot of Christians spending a lot of time and energy and money in pursuit of what pleases themselves. And in the process, you've all seen it happen. Maybe you've done it yourself. I know I've done it myself. The Lord gets shoved aside and ignored. This is no way to treat the I am of the world. No way to treat the light of the world. So we want to just be honest with ourselves and say, am I trying to learn what is pleasing to the Lord? And obviously there, not just to learn it for the sake of knowledge, but to implement that as well. Don't participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness. And let's face it, as we've already said, the world is filled with spiritual darkness and moral confusion. So Paul is not saying, find the nearest cave there and hide. You know, take your family, run to the nearest monastery, you know, or whatever it is, and just stay there until you die or until the world peters out, one or the other there. He's not saying that at all. What he's saying is, don't become the world that you live in. Don't assimilate. If you are the light of the world, that light cannot be ignored. And the best way, ironically, to magnify or to amplify light is to set it against a dark background. So I want you to think about this in a positive way, that as the world descends into further and further moral darkness, if we are maintaining ourselves as children of light, we are going to get brighter and brighter and brighter. At least that's how people will see us. And that will be an attractant to those who are looking for the truth. We won't be harder to find, we'll be easier to find. So those are good things. In the midst of some bad things, there's some good things. There's things to avoid and watch out for, but there's also good things that come out of that. And finally, Paul says, expose what is in the darkness with the light. Expose it with the truth. Unmask it. Unmask those things that are posing as light and truth and show them to be false. And that forces us to choose a side here. It also forces us to stand our ground. We can't straddle the fence and we can't sit on the fence because remember from an earlier lesson, the devil owns the fence. And you don't want to be on a fence that the devil owns. So, having said all that, the question is really not, is Jesus the light of the world? Because, first of all, he said he was, not wants to be, but is. And secondly, as we talked more so in the last lesson, he proved this over and over with all the miracles that he performed. So the real question then is this, is Jesus the light of your world? Is he truly the source of your enlightenment? Is he the source of all that is good and righteous and true in your life? Is he alone the source of spiritual life that energizes your faith? Now, if you are a Christian, and that and is necessary here, if you are a Christian and living faithfully to what that means, then Jesus Christ will radiate in all that you say and do to everyone, and everyone in your sphere of influence will be illuminated by this. They will see your good works, and they will glorify the God who is in heaven, because that's where the light comes from. But Jesus did not come as the light of the world to accept or condone or approve of what is done in darkness, but just as we have done or are to do, he came to expose that. I want to speak candidly as I close up here. Our sins and the sins of the world may sometimes seem rather slight to us. They may seem rather harmless to us. You may have sinned at one time and someone pointed that out, or you read about that and you went, well, no big deal. You know, everyone's human. You kind of brushed it off. When viewed in spiritual darkness, that's how people think. When you're in a cave of ignorance or denial or false reality or an artificial light, that makes sense. But when the light shines on you, it shows you for what you really are when you do sin against God. It is awful. It is wretched. You are in a grotesque condition. It's an ugly, horrifying thing. And when I think about hell, and I don't like thinking about that often, but that is a reality that Jesus spoke of. When I think about hell, what I think is all the ravages of sin brought upon human beings, absent of any virtue, the light of God removed from them, and whatever is left is thrown into an outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And to be in the company of that people, or what's left of people at that point, is just an awful thing to think about. Whatever other pain or torture is going on there, I don't even need to get into that. That in itself would be enough to be hell. But that's not what we want. Here's the other side of all that. This is John speaking in the revelation given to him. And it says, and the city, meaning God's church in glory, has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine on it. For the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb, which is Jesus Christ. That's where you want to be. Or at least I'm assuming that's where you want to be because you're here. And if that really is where you want to be, then you have to do something about that. Once the light exposes us, we all react to it one way or the other. We're either going to run to the light because we want to be healed and cleansed and redeemed, or we're going to run from the light because we're too proud or too ashamed or too scared or too unwilling to stop and change what we're doing. And so we're going to try to run and hide. Everyone here this morning is either running to the light or from the light of the world. No one is standing still. No one has opted out because no one can. So the question really comes down to each one of us, myself included. Are you running from or running to the light of the world? Have you been born of God? The only possible way that this could happen is that, first of all, you learned the gospel of Christ, you gave your full allegiance to Jesus as your Lord and Savior, and you were baptized in his name to demonstrate to everyone here and the whole world that that is now your allegiance. If you have been born of God, and the question is, are you living like one who has been forgiven and redeemed and healed and filled with a light? And if you are, excellent. Keep doing that. Don't stop. Don't let up. But if you're not, if you're born of God, but you're trying to marry light and darkness together in your life, and you're thinking it's okay, it's going to all work out, you've been deceived. And that deception will destroy you in the end if you allow it to continue. Jesus did not tell us that he is the light of the world just to give us something to preach on, but rather to draw us to the Father, where there is mercy and grace and forgiveness and salvation and hope. And these are all things that we all desperately need, that you desperately need. What is your response to that call? And I'll leave it right there. That is your invitation. If you do need to respond this morning, this is the time to do it. If you need to come forward this morning, well, this would be the time to do it. As we stand and sing.